My name is Frank Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here at the Cornhusker Roundup, and I would like to thank the committee for asking me to come and participate at your roundup. I love the enthusiasm. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what it's done in my life. And what I can say is if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work, and these 12 steps, and the way things are going in my life, I wouldn't be here today. Because I'm a comfort creature. I like to be comfortable. And I like to feel good. And since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been with you people, and I started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor, my life has changed and is comfortable a lot today. I can also tell you that I am not a member of ACA. I'm not codependent. I don't come from a dysfunctional family. I don't go to anything but Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'm a drunk, and I drank badly. And when I didn't drink, I acted badly. And when I acted badly, I had to drink. And then when I drank, I acted badly. And it was just a vicious circle. And I have no reason to be an alcoholic. I have no reason at all. Look at me. I don't even look like an alcoholic. I don't look like you folks. When I was growing up in Danville, Illinois, and I visualized and thought about what alcoholics look like, I thought about the people here at the Cornhusker Roundup. But I come from a very loving family. My mother and father were fabulous parents. My father worked the same job for over 40 years. Him and my mother have been married for over 50. I don't understand those two things, long-term job and long-term marriage. I have two brothers. They're both sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them has 5 years. The other one has about 8.5 years. I was fortunate enough to be at Alcoholics Anonymous when they got here, and I'm glad that I was. I had an absolutely ideal childhood. And looking back on it, if I could have written out a script for my childhood and how it was, I couldn't have written out a better script. I had everything going for me. I had a father that worked and a mother that was home. I played Little League Baseball, I played football, basketball, I run track. Because I was blessed with an amount of athletic ability. And I learned to play sports. And I didn't think I grew up with any problems. And when I got sober, I looked back and I seen that I did have some problems, but they were self-made because I'm the problem. You see, when I grew up, and there was a little girl next door, and her and I started playing doctor at the age of 6 or 7. And we started comparing the differences between her and I. I like the differences. Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't changed that. I still like the differences. But what happened was I grew up in a good home, and I knew right from wrong, and I knew about the Ten Commandments, and I knew the things that her and I were doing were wrong. But, you know, I didn't care. It felt good, so I kept doing it. And I stuffed the guilt. And I grew up also during the era of John Wayne and Wild Bill Hickok and Lash LaRue and all these macho guys. And, you know, when I was growing up, all I wanted to do was fit in with you guys. And I just wanted to be a part of that clique. I just wanted to be a part of that crowd and fit in with you, that you've heard other people say up here. And I wanted to fit in, and I never felt I fit in. You know, growing up, I felt like I was better than them, or I felt like I was less than them. I never felt even with them, and I don't know where that come from. You know, growing up also, I had a problem with perfectionism. And I know you can't tell that, but I had a problem with perfectionism. You know, I could walk around, and I do it today, and I try not to. My wife tried to help cure me of that. I can spot dust and lint on the carpet at 50 feet. And I walk around, and I pick up these little fuzz balls, and I say, how come all this stuff is on the floor? And she tells me, why are you always looking down? I can't answer those questions. So I quit looking down. I started walking around the house looking up, seeing the cobwebs in the corner. But, you know, this perfectionism got me in a lot of trouble. When you're playing doctor with a little girl next door and you're trying to be macho and tough, you ain't got anything to offer her at the age I was when I started doing that. So I started ironing my underwear. And I started ironing the sheets that I slept on. So I did those kind of things growing up that were never forced on me. And like I said, I grew up and I wanted to be a part of the crowd. And I grew up when the macho guys were on the silver screen. But, you know, I was frightened growing up. I was afraid of you guys. I wanted to fit in with you, but I didn't want you to get too close to me because I had some secrets. You see, growing up, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief. My parents never taught me to steal. The people that I was hanging out with didn't teach me to steal. They didn't teach me to lie and cheat, but I did those things. And I didn't want you to find out about them because I wanted you to like me. And so I would continue to do those things, and I'd stuff those feelings down inside me. And when you got too close to me, I'd push you away. And what happened was that I became a fighter. And, I mean, look at me. I'm trying to be macho, and I look like Mr. Peepers, for Christ's sake. Mr. Peepers isn't macho. But I got in these fights, you know, and I didn't want to hurt you, and I didn't want you to hurt me. And I started hanging out when I left basketball practice or football practice. I'd go down on Main Street in Danville, and down there in Danville, down on Main Street is where all the guys hung out that I wanted to be like because they looked cool. These guys had on black leather jackets. These guys had ducktail haircuts. These guys had long sideburns. They wore engineer boots, and they wore Levi's, and I liked that, and I wanted to hang out with them, but they scared me. And when they scared me, I'd have to fight to get them away from me because I didn't want them to find out about me. You see, also, I was afraid of the dark, and I couldn't tell anybody that when I was growing up. I was ashamed of that. And so when they'd get close to me, I'd have to keep them away, and I'd have to fight them. And I'm too light to fight and too thin to win, for Christ's sake. So I developed the technique of ambush. And I started hitting people with bricks and clubs and sticks to keep them away from me and to win the fight. And then I'd go home at night, and I'd think about the guy I hit in the face with a brick, and I felt bad for him. Now, I can't be macho and feel bad for somebody. I'd have to suck it up and act tough. And I had those feelings of guilt and remorse. And I had to push those feelings of remorse and guilt down inside me because I didn't want to face those things, and I couldn't handle those emotions. And that's how I grew up, with all those feelings and emotions that I couldn't deal with. And I never stopped and thought about it and think, hey, Jones, you know what? In 1989, you'll be in Nebraska speaking. You better remember this stuff. I didn't take notes on it. What I did was I just kept living that way, and, you know, I continued to fight, and when you grow up, the bigger you get, the fights get worse, and I started getting into some trouble. And I'd go play ball and stuff, and I'd still fight and get carried away, and I wasn't even drinking yet. And, you know, I was at a party one day back there in Danville, and it was a hot summer night back there. It was about 110, and it was humid. And I was with my girlfriend, and she brought me over a big 16-ounce tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And she handed that to me, and I hadn't drank. I didn't know what that stuff was. And I took a sip of it, and it tasted like strawberry Kool-Aid. And so I tried to lug that glass down. That was no big deal. And I got to tell you, nothing happened. You know, it didn't get down into my stomach. I didn't get all warm and fuzzy. That didn't happen. I didn't get 6'4" and weigh 220 pounds. What happened was that I did what I was going to do for a long time after that. I bossed her around. And I told her, go get me another one, and she did. And, you know, she brought me another 16-ounce tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And, you know, I drank that down. And, you know, I didn't cross some invisible line after that second glass. I didn't put on a trench coat and get a bottle of wine and put it in a paper bag and go hang out on Skid Row. That didn't happen to me. You know, nothing happened. I didn't think it was a big deal. You know, I drank about a gallon of that stuff in 30 minutes. Nothing happened. I just didn't think it was important, and I didn't think about it. And I can tell you this, about 35, 40 minutes after that last glass, I found out where Slow Gin got its name. I got drunk as hell. Yeah, I went into a blackout. Didn't know that. What happened was I got very sick, and I got taken home by some of my partners, some of the guys I wanted to fit in with. They took me home, and they dropped me off. And, you know, the next morning when I come to, I was vomiting, and my stomach was upset, and I had a headache, and it was throbbing and beating. And I was sicker than a dog, and I didn't know what in the hell done it. And my mom and dad was yelling at me, and I was in a lot of trouble. You see, I wasn't raised to be that way or do those things because I knew about the Ten Commandments and God. I'd been raised in a good home. And I was a jock. I was playing ball. For Christ's sake, I won 9 letters in high school. But I was sicker than a dog, and they were yelling and screaming at me. And, you know, I missed 3 days of school because I had a hangover. And I didn't know that. And, you know, I went back to school after missing 3 days, and I got with my buddies. And they told me what I'd done that night, and I didn't remember any of it. They told me that I was out there dancing. And I don't dance. I think dancing is a waste of motion. I'm usually playing doctor somewhere. I don't dance. I don't dance in AA. I think it's a waste of motion. Well, I dance with my wife. But, you know, they told me that this guy come up to me and he lifted off and they said I punched him in the face and he went through the screen door. And, you know, all these things. You know, I couldn't remember any of them. And I didn't know until I got here with you what a blackout is. You know, I don't know if any of you people had those things. So you don't know, I don't know how you drank. I just know that I found out what a blackout was here with you. That Frank Jones could consume amounts of alcohol. And when I did that, I would continue to function and do the things I was doing, but the next morning when I woke up, I couldn't remember them. Now, any of you have that happen to you? It sure happened to me. I couldn't remember that night, and I didn't know then what I know now, that that's a sign that I may have a problem drinking. You know, I didn't know that, and I didn't even think about it anymore. It did teach me one thing, though, and I'll tell you that. From that day, that summer day in Danville, Illinois, to the day I stand here before you tonight, right now, I have never, ever drank in 7-Up again. I don't drink it. That stuff makes me crazy. I can't remember the night before. I'm sick. I throw up the next day, so I just don't drink 7-Up. That was the answer. I was denying that from the word go. Alcoholism is a disease of denial, and I was denying it. I thought 7-Up caused all that. I say 7-Up today, and it kind of makes my stomach turn. But, you know, I didn't turn into a blazing alcoholic then, and I didn't go out and get the shakes and have to have a drink after that. I had some beers with the football team, and I kept fighting and everything. And I kept doing the things I was doing. I kept the lying, the cheating, the stealing, and all these feelings and emotions I stuffed down because I was ashamed. And, you know, finally all my buddies and everything and my girlfriend, they were talking about going to college. And they were talking about what they were going to major in and what they were going to do when they grow up. And, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. They were talking about what vocation they were going into. And, you know, I was too ashamed to tell them that I didn't know what the word vocation meant. I was ashamed of that. You see, I wasn't interested in learning anything in high school. I thought I had all the answers. I was a know-it-all. You know, I thought I knew everything, and I was interested in being cool and being slick and running with the girls and playing sports. So I didn't know what vocation was, and, you know, I had a couple of scholarship offers to go play ball, and that scared me because I had a lot of fear, and I couldn't tell anybody that, and I was still fighting and getting in trouble. And what happened was is if you're macho and tough like I am and you're afraid and you don't know what you're going to be when you grow up, I did what macho tough guys do at the age of 17, and 2 weeks before graduation, I quit high school. And my parents went crazy. And I went home and I went down and I did what macho guys do. You see, I got to be macho and tough. I don't want you to think I'm a wimp and a wuss because I don't ever want to be that. I want to be tough. So I did what tough guys do. I went down and joined the Marine Corps. And that's macho and tough. See, wimps and wussies don't join the Marine Corps. And I didn't think my dad had signed the papers for me. And when I got home, he signed those papers so quick it made my head swim. I found myself on a train going up to Chicago, and I'm sitting next to the guy that I want to be like. This guy's got a greasy ducktail haircut. He's got long sideburns. He's got that leather jacket on. He's got on engineer boots, and this guy looks cool. And I want to be like him. I want to feel inside the way this guy looks. God, I want to feel that. And he's drinking this stuff out of a little brown bottle, and he pokes me, and he says, "Hey, man, you want to hit off of this?" And I tell him, "Sure." And I take 2 or 3 big mouthfuls of that, and I swallow it down. Now, I don't know what you did when you were 17-year-old when you chug-a-lug whiskey. I'll tell you what I did. I threw that crap right back up. And I'm sitting there, and my eyes are watering. I got snot running out of my nose, and I don't look macho. You cannot look macho with snot running out of your nose and tears coming out of your eyes. And I got to tell you how bad I wanted to fit in with this guy. I wiped off my face, handed him that bottle back, and I said, "Boy, that was good." You see, I wanted him to like me. I wanted to fit in with him. I don't know if you ever wanted to fit in, but God, I wanted to fit in with him. He said, "You want another drink?" I said, "No, not right now." I'm not a fool until later. And what happened was I got sworn in Chicago, and I got drunk there at the hotel, and then I flew out here to California. And I ended up at Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego, and I'm sitting on that bus, and I'm cool, and I'm macho. And I got on my letter jacket, my white crew neck, and my flat top, and I'm a big deal, you see, and this guy gets on the bus, and he's got on a funny round hat, and he's got a shaved head. And, you know, I don't know how he picked me out of all those guys. I'm macho, you understand. I'm not a wimp like some of those guys I was with, but he picked me out, and he snatched me up by my jacket, and he threw me off that bus onto some yellow footprints, and he started calling me some dirty names and cussing at me. Names and cussing words that you people here in AA don't even use. And I felt inadequate and like a wimp. And I had to suck those feelings up, and I had to stick that chin out, and I had to act tough, and I had to act macho. And, you know, I was frightened, and I was scared, and I was full of fear, and I couldn't tell nobody that. I can't tell these guys. These guys are all older than me. These guys are all 19 and 20-year-old, and I admired them. And I wanted to be like those guys, so I sucked it up and acted tough. You know, I got through boot camp, and in October of 1962, I found myself on a ship leaving from Camp Pendleton, and we were headed down through the Panama Canal. And I'm going to go kill Cubans. Now, that's macho. I like that. You know, I seen John Wayne on the sands of Iwo Jima, and I'm on that ship going through the Panama Canal, and I'm scared because I'm going into combat, you understand. That's what I think. And I can't tell these Marines I'm going into combat with how frightened I am. How can I tell them that? So I'm sitting there on my rack, sharpening my bayonet. That's macho. And I'm full of fear, and I'm frightened. And I'm ashamed of those feelings, and I push those feelings down inside me. But some of my friends go break into the narcotics locker on that ship. And they bring me down a little morphine syrette. And I took the plastic cap off that morphine syringe and I stuck that needle in my leg and I squeezed that juice out. And the fear went away. And I went up on the deck of the ship that night and I laid out there all night looking at the stars. And I wasn't afraid no more. And if you'd have walked up to me that night on that ship and said, "Hey, Jones, you know why you're not afraid anymore?" I'd have said, "Yeah, I know why. I know why. Because I grew up all of a sudden and I matured. That's why. And if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to break yours." I didn't know then what I know now. I didn't know that when Frank Jones ingested any type of narcotic into the system, it ripped that fear out of my stomach that I felt. It shut that head off that was talking to me, and it made me feel calm and cool, and I felt the way you looked. I didn't know that then. I didn't know that until I got here with you and you told me that. Now, you're not going to hear any more stories about any drug use because I didn't use any more narcotics. I look at it this way. Anybody can become addicted to heroin. All you got to do is shoot it. If you shoot it, you're going to become addicted. There ain't no social heroin users. If you snort coke, you're going to become addicted to it. There ain't no doubt. There ain't no social coke users. But if you're going to be an alcoholic, the way I'm an alcoholic, you got to hang in there for a long time. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to wet your pants, crap your pants, abuse your family, lose jobs, alienate everybody around you for years to get here. And I did that one day at a time so I could be at this roundup. And I didn't use any more drugs, and I didn't get to kill any Cubans, and that upset me. I wanted to win the Medal of Honor and make my folks proud of me and make my girlfriend proud of me because I wanted to be macho. And what happened was we ended up going back through the canal, and then I ended up in the Far East, and we ended up in a place called Okinawa, and Vince spoke about that place, and that was a neat place. And the first night there, the guys come over, and they said, "Hey, Frank, let's go out and get drunk." And I said, "Let's go." Now, I didn't say, "Let's go out and have a highball, and then I'll go back to the barracks and write Mom and Dad letters." They said, "Let's go get drunk." And that's what I did. I went out with those guys to get drunk, and that first night in Neville, we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake, held about 2 gallons. It was about that big, cost 75 cents. We're standing out there in Neville, out there in these dirt streets, and these guys start passing that bottle around, and they're drinking it down, and everything, and that bottle gets to me, and I lift that bottle up, and I take 4 or 5 big mouthfuls, and I swallow it down. Now, sake tastes like Clorox. And I got to tell you this, I don't know what you did if you drank sake. I can tell you what I did with those macho guys I was standing with. I threw that crap back up. And my eyes are watering, and I got snot running out of my nose, and I'm trying to be macho. And I am feeling ashamed of myself and inadequate, and these guys are poking each other, pointing to me and laughing at me. And they're drinking it down, and it gets back to me, and I drink it and throw it up, and I drink it and throw it up. And that's what I tell you. You got to hang in. You can't let being embarrassed stop you. You've got to work at being a drunk. And I kept drinking it, and finally I held enough of that sake down that something did happen to me, and I remember it very distinctly. I remember it very distinctly. As I got some of that sake down, I looked at those 5 or 6 guys I was standing there with, and I realized something. I realized that those guys were punks. And I didn't need them around me, man. They were wimps. And I took off onto the Ville on my own. And I spent my whole paycheck that night on wine, women, and song. And I sat in that bar and I started drinking Akadama wine and I started drinking sake and I started drinking beer. I ain't never been a social drinker. I don't know about these people that sit in the bars and stir their drinks and play with the olives and tap the fruit. I don't do that. Never did it. Never have, never will. And what happened was I sit in that bar and a guy lift off from another battalion there. You don't have to fight the Navy or the Army or the Air Force if you're in the Marine Corps. You can just fight anybody because that's what macho guys do. So I hit him in the face with a pool cue. Marine Corps frowns on that. And what happened was I picked this Nason up and I gave her some money and her and I went off to do what we had to do and she went to get cleaned up and when she left the little hooch there, I stole my money back and set her hooch on fire. I thought that was macho. And Marines do that. I've seen that in the movies. And when I got back to the base that night and I passed out and the next morning I got up, I couldn't remember anything. And the guys come up and they told me what I had done and they started embellishing those stories. And I liked that recognition I got about drinking and fighting and the women and all that other stuff. But I had a terrible headache and I was vomiting and throwing up and my head was just ringing. And I couldn't shut my head off and it was just going crazy. And when they told me what I had done, I felt that guilt. And I didn't know if that little girl, what happened to her or anything else because I just didn't know because I had split when I set the hooch on fire and I had these feelings that I couldn't cope with, but you know I found out a secret over it. I went to my wall locker and I got out a bottle of Akadama wine. And I found out that if I drank 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of Akadama wine and I drank some water, something happened to me. That headache went away. My stomach ceased being upset and it settled down. And my thought was, I was a big deal and I was macho and that's what was expected of me. And I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17. And booze was the answer for me. I could do anything and booze would take the pain away. I could do anything or act any way, and if I felt ashamed, all I'd have to do is drink and I didn't feel that pain anymore. And I could go on and continue to act the way I thought I should act. And what happened was, is the Marine Corps frowned on those type of actions, and I started getting office hours and court-martials. And I'd make PFC, and I'd lose it. And I got enough PFC warrants at home to wallpaper my bedroom. And if you'd have walked up to me and said, Jones, you know what your problem is? Your problem is the drinking, man. I'd have told you, you're crazy. Drinking ain't got nothing to do with this. It's the company gunny, man. It's the CO. It's these people out here in the Ville. It's that other guy. He started it. And what I was doing was pointing the finger at everybody else. I never looked at me as being the problem until I got here with you people. I didn't know that I was the problem and that alcohol was the solution. I kept blaming everybody else. And they were the reason I was drinking. Hell, if they didn't act that way, I wouldn't drink. I didn't have a reason to drink. If you'd just leave me alone, if you'd stay out of my face, I wouldn't have to smack you. And that's how I thought about it. And I started hurting a lot of people over there because, like I say, I used bricks or clubs. It made me no difference. I developed the technique of ambush. It was great. I never got hurt if I hit you from behind. Never got hurt if I hit you with a jug about that size. And I didn't like pain, so I did that. And then the next morning, I'd feel bad, and I'd have to drink to take that shame away and that guilt and that remorse. And what happened was I ran out of money over there one day. And I didn't have any money to drink on, and I had to drink. And what happened was a cab was coming down the street, and I was starting to have a little bit of the shakes, and we stopped that cab, and me and my buddy was going to rob him, and I jerked that cab driver out of the cab, and I held his head down to the pavement, and I picked up the rock the size of a softball, and I beat that man's face in with it that day. And the Marine Corps really frowned on that. That was during Kennedy's People to People program. That wasn't very people to people. And what happened was I had a general court-martial, and my father had to fly to Okinawa, and I was facing a lot of time because it was assault and intent to commit murder. And I begged the Marine Corps not to throw me out. It's the only thing I knew how to do. It's the only thing I'd ever been proud of in my life was that. And I felt like I fit over there. And I begged him not to throw me out. And my father brought letters from home, and he paid for that man's reconstructive surgery, and he paid for his medical bills and his retirement. And if he had come up and said, Jones, the reason you did that is you're drinking. I'd have told you, drinking ain't got nothing to do with it. These guys keep overcharging us every time they take us someplace. They're ripping me off. And when I pawn my stuff, they don't give me the money that it's worth. And I just had reasons and excuses and everything else. And all what it was the alcohol. I had to have money to drink, and I didn't even know that then. Because I was always pointing the finger. What happened was is I was sentenced to 2 years confinement at hard labor and back to duty. And if you've ever been in the military, you know that can't happen. And if you spend more than 6 months, you're supposed to be discharged. And I had already spent a year locked up by the time all of this transpired. And when my paperwork got through, they let me out. And I was stationed at Camp Pendleton in California. And I met a girl and I married her. And what happened was I had to drink. And I drank and I drank, and when I was home and she'd run her mouth at me, I became violent at home and I became abusive. And I abused that woman. You know, I didn't know until I got here with you and that I talked to you and you showed me by your example. You know, I didn't know that she was an individual. I didn't know that she had the right to dress and act and be the person that she wanted to be. And I was trying to direct and control her and tell her how to act and what to say and what to do and how to clean that house. And then when she didn't do it right, I'd get crazy. And when I got crazy, I had to do things, and then when I did things, I had to drink. And then when I drank, I just hell with it. I had to go out in the bars, and then you'd come up, and if you came up to me, I'd hit you. And then I felt bad, and I drank, and I had to pick a woman up to validate my manhood because I was never enough. And then when I validated my manhood with another woman, I felt guilty. And then when I felt guilty, I had to drink. And then I'd go home, and it'd start all over again, and I abused her, and we had a daughter. And then, kids ain't supposed to cry, and they're not supposed to make messes in their diaper, and they're not supposed to make messes in the house, And I didn't know that I wasn't mature enough to be a husband and a father. I didn't know that I didn't know how to treat a wife or a child, and I abused that family. And the only way to take the guilt and the shame and the feeling that I had away was to drink alcohol, and when I drank it, made it all right. And then I could go out in the bars and do that. And I run around fighting in the bars, and I started carrying a gun. You see, everybody frightened me. I didn't know that I was immature. And I did this for a long time, and just that cycle of drinking and carrying on and being crazy. And one day they called me into the CO's office. They told me how macho and tough I was. And what they did was they issued me a rifle with a telescope on it. And they issued me some live ammunition and some hand grenades and stuff. And they sent me across the ocean to a little place called Vietnam. And I got to tell you this. Long before I went over there, Vietnam is not my problem. It's not my problem today. It's never been my problem. My problem is I'm a drunk. I'm an alcoholic. And I drank alcoholically, and I was a morning drinker and a daily drinker. 6 years before I ever went over there, so you're not going to hear me blame any of this on Vietnam. That is not my damn problem. But when I got over there and that airplane landed in Da Nang, I looked at those other Marines and I was filled with terror. I was filled with fear that I did not know how to operate. You see, I thought I was a big deal and I thought I was macho, but you see, I knew there was a war going on over there. I knew that people were dying over there, and I was so scared I couldn't tell anybody. I was so terrified I could hardly move, and I couldn't tell these guys that I was afraid. I'm going into combat with them. I'm not going to be in the rear with the gear. I'm not going to be doing some newspaper issue and supplies. I was a sniper, and I was attached up on a DMZ at Khe Sanh to recon. And I was going to be in the action, and I was absolutely terrified and immobilized by my fear. But you know what? I found out a secret over there. I found out that if I put 151 proof rum in my canteen, and I drank that, I became bulletproof and invisible. And it took that fear away. And what happened was we went up to Dong Hao, we flew up there, and then we went on up to Khe Sanh by truck convoy. And, you know, when we went out on the operations and we went out on patrols, all the things that you read about in Time Magazine and Newsweek, you see, I did those things. And all the killing and the maiming and the burning, I did that. And, you know, we'd come back in our harbor site at night or in the morning, and I'd start thinking about the things we had done the night before, and it couldn't register in my mind. You see, I couldn't justify that. You see, I wasn't raised to do those things. And I thought I was going to go mad, you see. My stomach was boiling all the time, and I felt a lot of pressure in my head. And all I had to do was take out my canteen and drink some whiskey, and you know, that fear went away. And what that fear did for me, and that alcohol did for me, was allow me to act the way I thought I had to act to validate my manhood and to be macho. You see, so I kept doing those things, and things got bad over there, and I'd done a lot of bad things. During March of 1968, during the siege of Khe Sanh, I got blown up. And I ended up back here in the States. And, you know, when I got home, I had a wife and I had a daughter that was 2 and a half now. And when I first went over, my wife was pregnant. She had a son born to us while I was on Hill 881, and I hadn't seen that boy. But when I got home, I was stark raving crazy. And I had to drink a lot of whiskey, you see, because I had a lot of guilt and shame. And I'd done a lot of degrading things over there. And I couldn't tell anybody about that. And you see, I had to drink. And then when I drank, she'd get on my case. And when she got on my case, I had to lash out at her. And those kids were crying. And she was chipping her teeth at me one day. And I told her if she didn't shut up, I'd kill her. And she didn't believe me. And I went in the closet in the bedroom and got a gun. And I walked back out into that kitchen, and I was drinking whiskey out of the bottle. And I got to tell you that there was a God in that house that day. You see, I had quit believing in God a long time ago. Because, you see, if there was a God, I'd already broken all 10 of the commandments. And I knew that if there was a God, that I was screwed. I knew I was history. And I didn't believe in God. I wanted to see a Polaroid picture of him. I used to think that was a slick thing to say. And there was a God in that house that day, and I found out that since I've been here with you. And that God was looking out for me and those children and that wife. Because, you see, I tried to get the safety off of that gun. And I had a 2 and a half year old daughter hanging on one leg in my pants crying, telling me, "Don't shoot her, Mommy." And I had a little boy crying, trying to stand up on the other side. And that woman kept running her mouth, and I was going to kill her. And that safety wouldn't come off. And I hit the spring on the back, and I pushed that spring back in, and that gun went off. And that bullet went down and went through my hand and come out the other side and went down between my legs where those kids were standing. And that bullet didn't strike either one of them. And I got to tell you, I'm lucky for that. You see, because I could have killed one of those children. And there's no doubt in my mind today as I stand here, as drunk as I was, and as crazy as I was, that I'd have killed that woman that day. But there was a God in that house that didn't allow that to happen. And what happened was, is I ended up going on the drill field, and I became a drill instructor. And I was a liar and a cheat and a thief there, and I abused those recruits, and I'm not proud of that. But I had to do that. You see, I had to validate my manhood. And I had to act the way I thought I had to act, and I had to drink to take those feelings away. You know what happened shortly after I tried to shoot that woman? You're not going to believe this. She divorced me. Hell, that's not funny. That's sad. I only fired one shot. I didn't even fire the whole clip. She was a wimp. She took the kids and split, and I was resentful of that and hateful of that for a long time. She ran off with a state policeman from Indiana. Made me brood. That's all right. I found another woman. You know how we are. This hall's full of them. Oh, I didn't mean that. But I found another woman, and I continued to fight Matt crazy in the bars and abuse recruits, and I started still carrying a gun, and I was carrying a knife now, and I was just nuts, and finally I couldn't handle it in the States no more, and I wanted to die, and I didn't have the guts to kill myself, and I was starting to urinate a little blood now, and I was just crazy from my drinking, and I volunteered and went back to Vietnam. And what happened was that I just wanted to die and I wanted somebody else to kill me. I'd already lost all of my self-worth. And I got to tell you this, that the only reason that I bring Vietnam up is a lot of times when I talk, veterans come up to me after the meeting and they come up and they talk to me about this. And they say, man, I just can't stay sober. I'm having a hard time with this thing, man. I've done a lot of bad things over there. And I just can't stay sober. And I got to stand there and I got to tell them when I'm through talking, it's just my opinion, that there's a thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've read that book since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, what that book tells me is that if I develop a spiritual concept of the AA program, and I find a higher power or a loving God, whatever I choose to call him, and that if I work the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and I get into action in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can stay sober no matter what. And it doesn't say in that book anywhere that if I've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people a lot of times, that you can't stay sober. That book doesn't say that. It says that if you do these things, and you apply these things to your life, and you try to change how you're living, and you go to meetings, you can stay sober no matter what. And I got to stand there and tell these veterans that if you're not staying sober, I think you're using Vietnam as a cop-out, and you don't want to stay sober. That doesn't make all of them very happy. But that's just my opinion. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me, and I don't think anybody's done anything worse or anything better than I've done. I'm just a drunk, and I had to do the things I had to do to get here. And I've dealt with my problems about that with you people in here and a loving sponsor and a loving God and a lot of people. And I have done those fourth and fifth steps. So that's the only reason I bring it up. And in that second tour in Vietnam, a lot of bad things happened, and they got worse for me, and so did my action. And I got to tell you how alcohol was still working for me. Alcohol was working and told me that these things weren't happening and that those were just the fortunes of war, and we were going to cross a river one day and we was going to do the things we had to do. And I had a radio man that couldn't swim, and he come up to me and he said, hey man, he said, I can't swim. I ain't going across the river with you, man. You're drunk and you're crazy. And I pointed my shotgun at him and told him if he didn't get in the boat, I'd kill him myself. And we went across that river that day, and we'd done those things that we had to do and that I had to do. And coming back across the river, I was in a blackout and that boat tipped over. And I had a hold of that man. And I come out of my blackout, and I was full of fear, and I was afraid. And I put my feet in his chest, and I kicked off of him. And I swam ashore, and when I looked back, he didn't come back to the surface. And, you know, I know that I was responsible for that man drowning that day. You see, I'm lifesaver qualified. And if I hadn't been drunk, I could have saved his life. And, you know, when I got out of that water, you know, I thought I was going to explode. I thought I was going to explode with the shame and the guilt that I felt, and I felt the pressure in my head. And I felt my guts were tearing apart. The only thing that saved my life and my sanity that day was one of my squad leaders brought me a bottle of 10 High whiskey. And by the time I drank half of it, my head told me that that was the fortunes of war. And that that was his misfortune. And I hope that I never forget that. I hope that I never forget what alcohol used to do for me. You see, because I had no regard for human life whatsoever when I drank alcohol, because alcohol made it okay. What happened was I ended up getting shot up again, and I came back to the States, and you know, I married that woman that I had met, and we had a daughter, and I started abusing that family. You see, I wasn't good enough or mature enough to be a father and a husband, and I had to drink, and I still had to go into bars and validate myself with other women, and I still had to be violent because I had a lot of shame and I didn't want you close to me. And what happened was, is after 11 years, I drank myself out of the Marine Corps. You see, they wanted me to come back after lunch, and I couldn't do that, you see, because I had to drink and I had to gamble, and I couldn't come back. And I ended up out of the Marine Corps after 11 years. And if you're macho and tough the way I am, there's only one thing you can do. I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a cop in California. And I took that attitude out on the streets with me. And I worked graveyard, and I was terrified. I was afraid of the dark, and I was afraid of those dark alleys. You see, the ghosts of my past were out there. And all the things I had done and the people I had abused were out there. And I had to drink before I went on duty, and I'm not proud of that. This is just what alcohol had to do to me to get me here with you people. And I quit asking a long time ago why I'm here and some other people aren't. You see, I'm here today because I'm supposed to be here today. That's the only thing I can come up with. But I couldn't tell my partner in that police car, I'm afraid, man. I'm afraid to go down these alleys. I'm afraid to work in the dark. And so I had to drink whiskey, and I abused a lot of people, and I was validating myself with other women and doing the things that I wasn't supposed to do, and I felt all that shame and guilt. And my police career come to an end. You see, I started having an affair with my partner. Now, don't get all excited. I'm not from Hollywood. I'm from Valencia. And my partner was a female. And She found out that I got my wife pregnant. And you know what that woman did? She shot me. That's not even funny. Only the Al-Anons were clapping. I can't even believe you're clapping and laughing. This is tragic. She damn near blew my head off. I have a finger you can lay in the park. There's a big gash out of my head. She almost killed me. Just because I got my wife pregnant? Jesus. That ended my police career. I got to tell you, I did the next thing that I think any alcoholic ought to do that's got a drinking problem. I got a real estate license. And I started selling real estate and drinking in the better bars. And I got to tell you this, that if you're sitting out there today and you think money, property, and prestige is the answer, if you think you had a little more money, if you had a house sitting on a quarter acre, two new Cadillacs in the driveway, and if your kids were wearing designer clothes, and if you had a big swimming pool in the back corner of that house that had a three-hole putting green around it, and little tiki torches and palm trees, that your life would be okay. If you're drunk the way I'm a drunk, I'm here to tell you that that ain't going to happen. Because it didn't happen to me because I had all of those things. I used to go on lifting appointments and stuff. I wore enough gold chains and diamonds, I looked like a damn pimp going out. I looked like a gigolo. And I had a $3,000 a month booze habit, and I didn't have a problem drinking. And I continued to drink and act crazy and abuse that family, and money didn't fix it. Money didn't change what was inside me. Money didn't change those feelings. Money didn't change the guilt. Money didn't feel the degrading things I was doing. Money didn't change those things. I was still the same Frank Jones. And I thought that alcohol would do it, but all alcohol did was shut my head off, and I started getting sicker from alcohol. And I started urinating and crapping blood now. And I started turning yellow. And I couldn't figure out what the hell my problem was. If you'd have told me, come up and said, Jones, your problem's drinking, I'd have told you you're crazy. If I could get a little more money. Hell, I only made $128,000 in 1976. I just need some more money. If I could get another woman, a bigger car, maybe I need a Rolls Royce. I need a house on a half acre, not a quarter acre. I need a house with 26 rooms, not 16, for Christ's sake. Don't tell me about drinking. And I just get crazy and alcohol wasn't a problem. And you know, I had a 42-inch waist and I didn't know what my problem was, so I changed brands of cigarettes. Made sense to me. Jesus! I gotta tell you, I was so stupid when I was drinking, I thought denial was a river in Egypt. I changed brands of cigarettes. I went from Old Gold to Viceroy. I switched to Winston. Winston turned my skin yellow and made my gums bleed. I didn't know what in the hell was wrong. I went back to Camel. I stood there at the age of 36 years old, and everything I'd wanted to be all my life, that house on a quarter acre was gone. The house was gone. The two Cadillacs were gone. My wife and kids moved up with their parents into a trailer in San Jose, California. And everything I'd worked all my life to get was gone, and I didn't know what in the hell my problem was. All I wanted to do all my life was be like my father. He's a loving man, a gentle man, and he raised us kids. And he was just an example of what an American husband and father should be, and that's what I wanted to be, and I didn't know where in the hell I went wrong. I didn't know what my problem was. Everything I own now was in a cardboard box in the back seat of a stolen car. And that's a hell of a note for a police officer. And I didn't know what my problem was. And I continued to drink and get crazy, and this woman finally took me into her house, and I nailed her window shut because they were out to get me, and I didn't even know who in the hell they were. And I was carrying a .357 6-inch Magnum and a butcher knife, and I was crazy, and I was in her closet, and I wouldn't eat, and I just drank, and I was nuts. And I didn't know what the hell my problem was. And I went to a doctor because I was starting to hemorrhage and had a lot of blood escaping from my body. And I went to the doctor, and he called me in after this examination. He said, Mr. Jones, he said, I got to tell you, you're 36 years old. And he said, you're an alcoholic. He says, you're dying. He says, you've got cirrhosis of the liver, a hole in your throat from dry heat. You got a lung and stomach infection and all these things that we get when we're a chronic drunk the way I am. And you know what I felt when he told me that? I felt relief. I told him, thank you. I wanted to die. I didn't have the guts to commit suicide. I was a wimp. And I told him, thank you. And he said, if you don't quit drinking, you'll die within 6 months. And I walked out to that stolen car and I picked the beer up off the floorboard. And I drove to a liquor store and I bought a case of beer and a fifth of whiskey and drove back to Los Angeles. And I started drinking as hard and as fast as I could because I wanted to die and I didn't know how. And I was just tired. And I walked around this woman's house talking to myself, and one day I was sitting in her bedroom and I just vomited a pool of blood on the floor, and I had a Colt 357 Magnum on her nightstand, and I was going to kill her and her three kids and then kill myself because the world outside these rooms sucked. And I couldn't find an answer to it, and I was going nuts. And I got to tell you how God works in my life when I don't believe in God. You see, I hadn't made any contact with my parents in over 4 years. You see, my parents are old and they're retired and they vacation in Florida in a different spot every year. They go to Orlando or Dade County or Miami or someplace and they just get a little apartment and they stay there for the winter. And I hadn't talked to them in 4 years. Last time they seen me, I'd been working for my brother. I was drunk. And I told him if he didn't give me his money, I'd kill him and burn his house down. And I showed up in the morning with a can of gas, a gun, and an attack dog. He gave me some money and I split to California. And I hadn't seen or talked to him in 4 years. And I am sitting on her bed and I take that cocked gun and I put it in my mouth and I didn't have the guts to pull the trigger. And I was just mad. And I picked that telephone up and I dialed a telephone number. And on the other end of that telephone, my father answered the telephone. And you know, I don't know how that happened. I do today. I didn't then. You see, I had a loving God that was watching over me, and I don't know where that number comes from, except that God provided that number for me. And that may sound hokey or hinky to you, but I didn't know where my parents were. And my dad asked me what the problem was, and I told him that I'm an alcoholic and I'm dying, and I need a hospital. And I had never surrendered in my life. I have been through the best psychological warfare school the Marine Corps has got. I've been through the best POW schools and training that the military's got, and I can stand a lot of physical pain. I can handle a lot of pain. But I was history, man. I was tired, and I had had alcohol up to my eyebrows. And he got the phone number where I was, and to make a long story short, I ended up in a hospital in Indiana. And when they took me in that hospital, they lashed me down to a bed, and I didn't understand that. And they started giving me shots of my vitamin B and magnesium to help me with my withdrawal, because they told me I was physically addicted to alcohol the way a heroin addict is to heroin. And they told me I was supposed to get 5 or 6 of these shots, and I ended up getting 24 of them. And I had the hallucinations and the DTs, and they called my wife in California, this doctor did. And he said, I suggest that you fly back to Indiana and be with your husband. We think he's going to die before he gets through these DTs. You want to know what my wife said? Let that son of a bitch die. I was crushed. I don't know what you're laughing at. I didn't die. They're not doing this with mirrors up here. This isn't a videotape. I didn't die. And they unlashed me from that bed and they cleared up my physical ailments and they arrested the infections and diseases I had inside me. And this hospital is going to be kind of weird. It is for the people in California when they hear this part of it anyway. That hospital wasn't interested in my money. What they was interested in is I go to AA meetings. And it was mandatory that if you're in this hospital that you go to 2 meetings a day. And that you sit there and you listen. And I went to those AA meetings in that hospital. And what I heard was, is go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings if you want to take a drink. If you want a drink, go to AA. Go to AA for 90 days. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you want a drink, go to AA. And I thought, if I want a drink, I'll go to AA. And if I want a drink, okay, I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And you know, I couldn't remember the words of the Lord's Prayer. I couldn't remember my kids' names or where they were at. I couldn't remember a lot of things, and I thought I had brain damage, and I walked with a limp, and I stuttered, and I had a speech impediment, and I didn't know what my problem was. But I didn't desire to take a drink, and I haven't had a desire to take a drink since that first day in there. I haven't had it. But I kept hearing that. That ain't a big deal. That ain't a big deal. I got worse. You see, I didn't go to AA. They said go to AA if you want a drink. But you see, I did all the things in that hospital I was supposed to do, and when I walked out those 2 glass doors, I stood out there in that Indiana sunlight, and what happened was I stood out there stark raving sober, and I had no desire to take alcohol into my body, but what happened was all 10 of the commandments I had busted come walking down and got up on my chest and started choking me out. And all the disrespect and all the stealing, lying, and cheating I had done with my parents come down and started choking me out. And all the abuse I had heaped on those 2 wives and 4 kids came down that sidewalk and got up on my chest. And all the things I'd done in Vietnam and in that city that I was a cop in come down and started choking me out. And I thought I was going to go crazy, and suicide became the only answer. Unless I felt pretty good about me, and then I thought maybe I'd kill you. You see, homicide or suicide is the only thing I understood. I didn't desire to take a drink, so I'm not going to AA. I don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because they don't want to drink. And I heard them say, if you want to drink, go to AA. And I got to tell you this, if you're new or used out there tonight, that if you are intense when you quit drinking, I got to tell you, what happened to me might happen to you if you do what I did. If you're a little bit tense, if you get out here on this freeway and people that drive in front of you in the fast lane at 45 and 50 make you crazy, or you go in grocery stores and the list says 10 items or less cash only, and some dummy in front of you has got 15 items and a checkbook out, if that makes you crazy, and you get a little bit tense about that, the way I get intense about it, what happened to me might happen to you. After 13 months of no Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I didn't go to AA. I got my wife and kids back. We moved into a garage in Newhall, California. We slept on the floor and ate out of a styrofoam chest. And my wife said that I got a lot worse sober than I ever was drinking. I had a nervous breakdown. I flipped out. All my grapes were squashed. Squashed all my bananas. I just went nuts. I don't know why. I wasn't drinking. I was still lying, cheating, stealing, validating myself with another woman, driving a stolen car, abusing that family, carrying a gun, hanging out in the bars, drinking club soda with a lime twist. And I went cuckoo. I don't understand it. Beats the hell out of me. I was in an office one day. This guy come by and says, "Hey, Jones, how you doing?" I thought that was a personal question. I didn't think it was any of his business. And I grabbed him by the throat. And I pulled him over on the desk. And I told him, "How in the hell do you think I'm doing?" And I flipped out. I just went crazy. And these guys come running over there and they started trying to pull me off of them, and I was kicking and screaming and slobbering and nuts. And I got to tell you how God works in my life. You see, I got to be body slammed. I don't get subtle messages. You can't tell me bring the body and the mind will follow. That's bull. It don't work for me. You can't tell me something and expect me to do it. You got to beat me. You got to abuse me. You got to drag me behind the semi-truck. You got to get the message through. But there was a loving God in that office that day because there was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that man walked up to me and laid a card down, and they're holding me and I'm crying and screaming. And on that card was the number of a man. And he said, "I know what's wrong with you." But he said, "I can't help you." He said, "I suggest that you call this man." And I couldn't call him. I was crazy and I was just too nuts. And I just got nutter and nuttier and nuttier. And finally one day that man called for me. And I finally went down to see this man, and I drove my stolen car down there. And I walked into his office, and I sat in his office, and I cried. And I cried. And what that man explained to me that day was is that I didn't have a problem with drinking. He told me that you haven't had a drink in 13 months. He said, "You've got a problem with living." And he said, "What I suggest to you is that you find a living answer to your living problem in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he told me that I needed to become committed to these meetings. He told me that I had to do certain things. And I just sit there and cried when he talked to me. He told me that I had to come to these meetings and I had to sit in the front row. He told me that I had to take the cotton out of my ears and I had to put it in my mouth. He told me I had to listen. He suggested to me that I start reading the big book. And he told me that for me, I should read the black part and not the white. He told me that I had to start believing in a God. He said, "You know what? Somebody hangs that moon out there at night and they take it down in the morning and he says, it's not you." He told me that I had to get down on my knees at night and I had to thank God for keeping me sober and for having a good day. He told me when you get up in the morning, he said, "Roll out of your sleeping bag and get on your knees and ask God to keep you sober that day." And I listened to the things that man was telling me. You see, he was right. He was right that I have a living problem. I don't have a drinking problem. I haven't had a drink for a long time. It's been almost 9 years. But I can tell you this, that I've been to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and at no time have I ever seen anybody sit here and drink a bourbon and water. I haven't seen anybody come in here and pop the top on a bud. So I guess that in here it just don't deal with drinking problems, because I haven't seen any. And he's been right, because I started coming to these meetings and what I seen was people learning how to live. He told me that what I had to do is I had to start doing a lot of things. He said, "You have to get commitments at the meetings." He told me, "You have to make the meeting yours." He said, "Don't let the meeting be theirs." He said, "Because when it's their meetings, you don't have to go to it. You can find reasons not to show up." He said, you get commitments at the meetings. And he said, I don't want you getting any high-profile commitments. He said, I want you to clean up or empty the trash or sweep the floors or something. He said, I want you to make the meeting yours so you're there every night. And he said, I want you to go to a meeting every night. And he said, I want you to show up unless there's a death in the family and it's yours. And you see, I understood that. And he told me that I had to start doing these things. And what I did was, he told me to go to a meeting that night. And when I stood up to leave his office, I was still crying. And he come around from behind his desk and he put his arms around me. And you know, when I look into that man's eyes, I knew something that day that I hadn't known for a long time. I knew that he knew me, and I trusted that man, and I don't know why I did, but I did. And he told me to take my pack off, and he said, you don't have to hurt yourself anymore if you don't want to. He said, you don't ever have to take another drink. And he said, you can get comfortable if you start working these 12 steps and you start doing it in your daily life. And he says, you don't have to hurt yourself anymore. And he just hugged me, and I just stood there and cried. And I walked out of his office that day, and I went to a meeting that night. And I did what that man told me to do. I sat in the front row. And when I got there, he told me that I should shake hands. And I stuck my hand out, and I wasn't interested in knowing you. I wasn't interested in knowing you because you hadn't done the things I had done. You hadn't abused the people that I had abused. You hadn't done the things overseas I had done. You didn't drink the way I drank. You didn't do your family the way I'd done my family. I looked at every excuse not to like you or be around you. But I was hurting so bad, and I trusted that man so much that I stuck my hand out, and I did what he told me to do. And what I did, what happened to me when I come into these meetings, is I walked through the door, and none of you walked up to me and said, hey, where you been? What kind of car are you driving? What kind of job you got? How'd you treat your family? You didn't do any of those things. What you did was is you stuck your hand out to me, and you said, you're welcome here. Why don't you get a cup of coffee and sit down? And what you did more than that is you showed me by your example how Alcoholics Anonymous worked. You see, you read the steps to me in chapter 5. You read the steps to me and you read the traditions to me. And I heard them now. And I didn't understand them. And you knew that I might have been a hard study because you have been where I've been and I didn't know that. And what you did was is you set an example for me to follow. I didn't listen to your words, I watched you. I watched you like I've watched you at this convention. I watched you when you walk in with your husbands and your wives and how you put your arms around each other. I watched how you treated your children. I watched how you hugged them. And you see, I wasn't doing any of those things when I got here. You see, I had quit loving my wife a long time ago. All I knew was abuse. All I knew was hate. All I knew was anger. All I knew was just pushing people away from me. And I watched you long enough, and what you told me to do, you said it's easy to do it in here. What I want you to do, Frank, is take it home with you. I want you to take it home with you. And what I did was that I watched you, and I tried to take it home with me. I tried to treat my wife and my kids with respect. And my sponsor told me, you know, I went to him, and I said, you know, I got a daughter. And I said, she tells me she loves me when she goes to bed at night. And I said, I can't tell her I love her. And he told me, don't be a dummy. He said, you reach out every time that little girl walks by you and touch her and tell her you love her. He said, she don't know you don't love her. He said, you just tell her. And in time, you'll learn to love her. And you know, I got two daughters. And I left his office, and I went home, and I went back to that garage. And every time those two kids walked by, I reached out and tried to touch them, and they ducked. And I told them, I love you. And I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. And it took a long time for me to start meaning it. But I kept doing it because he told me to do it, and you told me to do it. And I watched you do it, and it was okay for you, so I did it. And you told me how to treat my wife. You told me to put my arms around her. You told me when I come in, just like my sponsor told me, he says, when you get home, ask her how her day was, and then stand there and listen. I used to wiggle my toes in my shoes. I didn't do what Marianne did. I wiggled my toes in my shoes. I wasn't interested in her. I was interested in me. I wanted to inflict myself on everybody around me to stand still and listen. But I had to stand there and listen to her. And you know, in time, by doing that, day after day after day and going home, I started becoming interested in what she was saying. Not all the time. My sponsor tells me I'm never going to rise above wonderful. He said, all I'm going to be is a human being. And so I stood there and I listened to her, and I kept doing the things you told me to do. My sponsor told me I had to be self-supporting through my own contributions, and he told me to get a job. And what I did is I didn't know how to get a job, and he told me to suit up and show up, and he told me about getting the want ads. And to make the calls and to show up at the interviews. He said, take the first job you're offered. And I became a security guard, and that's beneath my station. I'm a combat veteran, and I'm a cop. And by God, I'm something to be conjured with, and I don't want to be no $3.75 an hour security guard. And I took that job, and I went to work at midnight after the meetings. And when I got my first paycheck, I stood there and I cried. I couldn't believe it. If I didn't need the money, I wouldn't have cashed it. I'd have framed it. Instead, I Xeroxed it and framed it. But it's the first honest money I'd earned in a long time. You see, I had ripped people off all my life. And what happened was, hell, there's times today I look at that Xerox copy of check and think, I wonder if they'll cash that. It's still in the frame. I won't try to cash it today. But I felt good about that job, and I felt good because that's the first honest money I had earned. And what I've had to do is I kept judging myself by my intentions, and all of you people were judging me by my actions. And what my sponsor told me I had to do is he said, you have to start changing your actions. I had to quit using these ethnic terms that I used. I had to quit using four-letter words. I had to start learning how to speak again because he told me that you can't cuss and you can't act that way. And I had to change how I was living. I had to do a 180-degree turn. And I had to start being gentler with people. And I had to quit doing that attitude that I had, and I had to quit trying to push you away. And I had to start doing those things. And what I believe in my life today is that most of the time, when I let it be, my life is God-directed through sponsor direction. And that's how it works for me, you see. Because without my sponsor, I really don't think I'd be here today. I wouldn't be anywhere because I know where I was without him. And I don't know where I'd be without the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, they came in before me and they're walking that path for me. They're running point. I don't have to. They're showing me how to do it if I'll just open my damn eyes and watch them. And the easiest thing for me to do is to be loving in these meetings. The hardest thing for me to do is to take these 12 steps home with me. That's where it's hard to work the program. It's hard to work the program at the job. That's the bastard running the company don't know how to do it. I need to show him. Look, I'm sober. Let me show you how it's done. Having a job in sobriety is the hardest thing I've got. It's the hardest thing I have to do in sobriety is keep employed. And I don't know why. Hell, I didn't have that problem in drinking. But I've got to take the program outside with me because out there is where it counts. In here it's easy because, you see, I know how you feel behind your belt buckle and you know how I feel. You know how I feel. And I've got to keep doing these things. I've got to keep taking the action. I've got to get the commitments and I've got to go to the meetings and I've got to listen. I've got to believe in a God. And I do believe in a God. And I can say God, and it's not a three-letter word that I'm ashamed of anymore. And I got to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has put God, AA, and Al-Anon in our home. Because without God, AA, and Al-Anon, we wouldn't have a home. My wife attends Al-Anon meetings, and she's involved in Al-Anon. And I let her work her program, and she allows me to work my program. And we do our thing like you've heard here today. And you know, sometimes I have more time on my hands than she does, so I help her with her program. That's no problem. I can do that. She's never had a break. She did her inventory. I said, you don't have to. I've got a typed copy. Give it to your sponsor. But she allows me to do my program, and she allows me to go to a lot of meetings, and I go to meetings almost every night. And I got four or five regular meetings that I attend, and she allows that. And I got four children, but my middle daughter was 16. She went to Alateen for a while, and she appears to be a normie, and she's a lovely girl. And I got to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous, they hasn't given me the clothes that I'm wearing. Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't given me these clothes. If you want clothes, go down to Mervyn's or Kmart or wherever the hell you buy your clothes. We don't issue them here. What you got to do is get a job, become self-supporting, and buy your clothes. Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't given me the car I'm driving. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't a car dealership, for Christ's sake. You have to get a job, you have to work, you have to make payments, and you have to do those things. Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not a job service or an employment agency. I had to get the one ads, and I had to take sponsored direction and find a job. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't some social club for me. I'm dealing with a life or death disease here. And I believe that if I don't do the things I'm supposed to do, I'll die from this disease or go crazy. And I know we have a lot of fun here. And I know that there's a lot of lovely ladies here. But since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous and with my sponsor in this group, I haven't had to validate myself with another woman. You see, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in my wife, and I love my wife. And this last Monday, we were married for 18 years. And she's seen the good and the bad, and it's time that I give her the good. And I feel that she has earned that. And I have to do that because she's a lovely lady. And I'm glad that we're married. And I'm glad that I can share my life with her today. Because I sure tromped over hers long enough. And we can have a lot of fun here, and this is an honest program, it's a truthful program, and my sponsor tells me I can think anything I want to think, as long as I don't act on it. And I lust after a lot of you women in here, because you are some foxes. I just don't act on it. Not today. Not to... Short-term gain, long-term pain. I don't need it. But I got to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to sit down at night and eat a meal, and I don't throw it up. Alcoholics Anonymous allows for me to stand in my bathroom and shave in the morning, and I can look in the mirror. You see, the first 3 or 4 years I was sober, I used to walk around shaving because I couldn't stand to look at the guy in that mirror. I hated myself so bad I wanted to die. But today I can stand and most of the time look in that mirror, and I like the guy that I see in there because I'm doing the best I can today. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to lay down at night, put my head on the pillow, and I sleep all night. And that's a gift because I didn't sleep all night when I got here. I used to wake up and search the house and wake up soaking wet and wake up full of fear and that anxiety, and I don't have to do that no more. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous fills up my holes the way alcohol used to. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to feel like a human being most of the time. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to show up at work and to give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles and traditions here allows me not to make this fun and games and to hit on everybody and to be cute. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to feel like a man most of the time. The one thing that I've always wanted to be, Jim said it on Thursday night, Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to show up. When I say I'm going to be somewhere, I'm there. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to dress up and stand in front of you so I can be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is that family at home. Besides my two brothers that's sober, I have the two children at home, and I've got two that are away from home, and those two at home ducked and dodged every time I walked by. And I got to tell you that one of the greatest gifts is I've got a little 12-year-old at home now, and she was 6 years old, and she wasn't telling me she loved me or hugging me, and I'd been going home and telling her and touching her and trying to get close to her, and she wouldn't let me. And I was about 3 years sober, and I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and we'd moved out of that garage and off the floor, and we'd moved into a little house, and we got real furniture now that some people would give us and stuff. And I'm getting ready for a meeting, that little girl just taking her bath, and she was ready for bed, and she come running by that chair I was sitting in, and she stopped and she looked at me, and she crawled up in my lap, and she put her arms around me, and she gave me a kiss, and she said, "I love you." And that was the first time in her life, and she was 6 years old, that she had ever said, "I love you" to me. And the first time she had ever kissed me. That's what you've given me, you see. And the feeling I had that night, you can't get out of a bottle. You can't get that out of a bottle of whiskey. And you know, she's been doing it a lot since then. You know what the little type did? She's 12, and she went out and took golf lessons to learn to play golf so she could be with me. You see, that can't happen to me. And my oldest daughter, my 16-year-old, she made cheerleader, and I got to hug and I got to cry with her and tell her how happy I was with her and how happy and proud I was of her. And we got to share that moment, and that was good. And you people allowed that to happen by your example and by telling me to take it home with me. Those are the gifts you've given me. I can lay down at night with my wife and put my arms around her, and I can tell her that I love her. And she puts her arms around me and says, "I love you too." That can't happen from where I came, you see, because they were terrified of me. And life isn't all just bed of roses, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, bad things happen. Bad things happen. My father has a blood clot on the brain and Alzheimer's, and he's dying. And my oldest daughter was 24-year-old, had disowned me because she said I was the reason for her problems, and she had never lived with me. But she blamed me. And I had to let her do that, and I called my sponsor crazy, and he said, "Why don't you just let her be her, and you be you, and you keep doing what a dad does. You send her a card on her birthday and for Christmas, and you just keep being there for her should she ever change her mind and come back to you." And you know, April of this year, in January, I got a call from her, and she said, "Dad, I'm getting married in April, and I want you to come back." And she apologized for how she was. You see, I stayed with you long enough and was an example long enough that she called. And in April, I went back to her wedding, and I got to visit my father. And, you know, I didn't want to do that because that's tough for me because I've become a wimp in sobriety. And I knew that was going to be hard. And what my sponsor said was, "Why don't you just suit up and show up and know that he's got a God in his life, just like you do? And why don't you just support your mom and help take care of him?" And, you know, I went back there, and I did that. And I took him to the wedding. And he just erupted it and raised hell. He don't know what he's doing, but I was proud to be with him. Because, you see, I wanted to be like him. And if I wasn't sober, that wouldn't have happened. You know, I had a son that the hardest thing I've had to do in sobriety was put him out when he was 15 years old. But I called my sponsor and he said, you can't have drugs and alcohol in your home. You have to put that young man out. And I packed his clothes up and set him on the porch. And I put him out. And he lived on the streets of Hollywood and he run wild for a long time. And he's a drug addict and alcoholic. And that was tough to watch. And I watched him almost die. And I watched him be arrested for murder. And I watched him be arrested for robbery. And I watched him do the things that I was doing. And he got put in prison. And I didn't go to his trial because I didn't help put him there. And he was still drinking and using. And my sponsor and you people said, why don't you just stay here and be an example for him? And I had to ask you what the difference was between release and indifference. And you said, do you still love him and still care about him? And I said, yes. And you told me, then you've released him. If you didn't care, you're indifferent. And he spent 5 years in prison. And I went down to see him in December, and he was clean and sober. And last Tuesday, he got released. And he's in my home group. And that can't happen. And he has a sponsor. And he's gone to a meeting every night since he's been out. And I don't tell him how to do his program. It ain't none of my business. All I can do is be an example, and I learned that from you. I've lost a business in sobriety. I lost all my money in sobriety, and I've had to start over. None of those things that I just mentioned would a drink make any better or change. And I learned that from you. And what I've got to do is stay here with you. Now, the things I've said today mean nothing to you. They don't mean anything. What I've done here today is I've said what I used to be like, and I need to hear that. I need to hear what an animal I was, how angry and hateful and disregard for human life I had. I need to see the miracle of how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I look back on it, to me, it's truly a miracle that I'm alive and sober today. I need to see how I got to you people, and I need to hear how my life is today. I need to hear that I'm centered. I got a little dignity most of the time. I try to do the things that you've shown me how to do, and I've got to hear myself say that I have a good life, because, you know, sometimes I forget and I lose my gratitude. So the things that I've done here at this podium today are for Frank Jones. They're for me. I'm a drunk, and I'm a bad drunk. But today, I'm a human being. I'm never going to rise above that, and I try not to do the things I used to do, and I try not to drink today. And I try to live in today, because today is all I got. Yesterday is gone, and I can't change a thing. I'd go back and change a lot of things if I could, but I can't. And I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, so I have to stay sober, and I have to do the things today, right now, because all I've got's right now. And if I put enough right nows together, I'll get to tomorrow. And that's what you've taught me. And I think that the only thing that you should remember, it was read at the Thursday night meeting, and you probably didn't even pay any attention to it. And to me, it's one of the most important things I hear at every meeting, because I watch the old-timers, and they're the ones that I keep my eye on. And what that thing said Thursday night that was read, if you're new or used tonight, keep it right in front of you and try to remember those words. And what those words are is the first line of Chapter 5, and the first line of Chapter 5 says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thank you.